It's Friday, April 8, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. We're going to watch over the next day and find out if, indeed, the federal government is going to shut down. We'll know by late tonight if, in the intervening hours, some agreement is not reached, the federal government will shut down. Now, what will that mean? Well, for most of us, actually, immediately, it will mean very little. But over time, it could mean a great deal with national parks and other federal facilities shutting down. It also means a lot of federal employees being sent home. A fascinating viewpoint on that is presented by the Wall Street Journal as Jarrett Adami reports that federal government officials, the employees, will be asked to report to work on Monday. That is non-essential workers, and they'll be asked to turn over their BlackBerries, laptop computers, and other devices that allow them to access the office computer systems. Then they're going to be sent home. Now, you're going to love this statement from the official, quote, "If an employee is furloughed, it is illegal, a criminal violation for them to work," end quote. Where there is your federal government at, not work. It is a crime to work if Uncle Sam tells you you're off. Now, this is a grave partisan divide. It is a major debate. As I said yesterday, it's a debate over something that at least matters. Even though it is a political circus, it's the kind of political circus that actually does involve debate over matters of grave consequence. The Democrats, when they were in control of all the branches of government, failed to pass a budget in the last Congress. It then fell to this Congress, and it set the stage for a political showdown of quantum magnificence here. We're really watching politics come down to a debate over what government is, what government should pay for, how the government should pay its bills, and how we should look to the future. The big issue here is, of course, that most of the money that is being spent here is locked into several entitlement programs in the defense budget that is largely, at this point, untouchable. But the reality is that a good percentage of the money that's being spent in this budget is going to be paid for by our children and generations to come. We are literally spending out of the wealth and income of future generations, passing on to them a debt, which is not only unprecedented, but frankly, almost unbelievable. We'll see where this goes, but at this point, it is good for parents, for instance, as you introduce this issue to your children, you see it discussed in the public square, to remind them that budgets really do matter. The family budget matters, a church budget matters, and yes, the federal government matters, and we have a stake in this as citizens. We're going to watch it carefully. If it does shut down, not all of the lights will go out in Washington, D.C. You know, one of my favorite vocabulary distinctions in this entire debate is between essential and non-essential employees. I'm not sure exactly how they determine that, but my guess is when the federal government defines essential, it's a fairly elastic definition. Speaking of circuses, few circuses can compete for terms of obscenity with what's going on in Milan, Italy, where Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi went on trial on Wednesday against charges that he had had a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old Moroccan dancer named Ruby. Well, we need not go into the salacious details in order to point out that the Italian prime minister, who's considered a conservative politically in the European context, is anything but conservative in his private life. In other words, even as he is defending himself over against this particular charge of having a relationship with an underage prostitute, he's basically admitting to the larger picture here, which is a life of extreme sexual excess, going on into promiscuity that is virtually unthinkable in an American context. And when you think about what America's been through the last 20 years, that's saying something. But Italy is a very fragile government in the first place and political system. Over the course of the 20th and 21st centuries, Italy has been through a succession of governments that rise and fall. The government of Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi is fragile. And by the way, Mr. Berlusconi, who's described himself as, quote, the most persecuted man in the universe, end quote, is facing three other trials on charges of corruption, tax fraud, and embezzlement. Now, one of the things that Christians should watch in this is that this Italian circus in this trial, which, by the way, will not resume until the 31st of May, is trying to draw a divide between public office and personal morality. Now, there are severe limits to that, and those limits are being tested in Italy. The public has a right to expect that those who will have the credibility to lead will live lives that are free at least from the kind of scandal that would ruin their ability to function in public. Well, leader after leader, ruler after ruler, president, prime minister, potentate, king, you name it, has been through scandals, and those scandals have taken their toll. And what is going on now in Italy is a scandal whether or not any crime was committed. And we'll see how the Italian people end up dealing with that. At my website at albertmuller.com, I posted a major article on Richard Dawkins, the world's most famous atheist and the world's most famous evolutionary theorist as well. In a book he published entitled The Greatest Show on Earth, he is arguing that evolutionary Darwinism is, as he says, the only game in town. Now, I wrote my article about it not because the book just came out, it's a couple of years old, but because it has just come out in a German edition, and in preparation for its release in German, Professor Dawkins gave an interview to Der Spiegel, which is the German equivalent of the New York Times and Time magazine wrapped into one. By the way, the title of the German edition of the book is The Creation Lie, and the subtitle is Why Darwin is Right. And Mr. Dawkins was speaking to Der Spiegel about the book, and he repeated some of the most strident arguments that he makes, including the fact that he dismisses those who do not believe in evolution basically as idiots. He says anyone who is informed, anyone who is intelligent, accepts evolution. He says this beyond reasonable doubt, that is, evolution is confirmed, beyond serious doubt, beyond sane, informed, intelligent doubt, beyond doubt, evolution is a fact. He then goes on to make this statement. The evidence for evolution is at least as strong as the evidence for the Holocaust, even allowing for eyewitnesses to the Holocaust. End quote. Now, I want you to notice the public relations, the rhetorical strategy that is going on here. Richard Dawkins and others of his ilk in terms of evolutionary scientists want to completely marginalize all those who believe in God, who believe in creation in any sense, to any degree, as being unintelligent, rationally insane, deluded, uninformed, and dangerous. But there's a moral aspect to his argument that is brought into the picture when he tries to make the denial of evolution tantamount to the denial of the Holocaust. Just let that argument sink in for a moment, and you'll recognize the rhetorical advantage that he's seeking to gain there. It is an obscene and extreme act, and one he needs to be called on and for, and that's why I wrote my article entitled The Only Game in Town, Richard Dawkins and the Limits of Reason. The reason I talk about the limits of reason is because the kind of arguments that Richard Dawkins makes in this book are far beyond the kind of arguments and the mode of argumentation you would expect of a scientist. He's really an evangelist for evolution, and he's writing as something that, someone who reflects what can only be described as a paranoia about those who disagree with him. He wants to marginalize all those who do not believe in evolution. Frankly, he considers us dangerous. He's absolutely frightened about the fact that about 40% of those in America, for instance, absolutely categorically reject the fact that we came to being, that as human beings came to being, merely through the process of evolution. Now, if you define evolution the way he defines evolution, only a small fraction of Americans are actually in agreement with him. The interviewer of Der Spiegel said, "Aren't you afraid that some of the people that they might be alienated by the sometimes strong language in the book? You call your opponents Holocaust deniers, ignorant, ridiculous, and deluded to the point of perversity." Dawkins answers, "My suspicion is that more people will find it amusing. If I had read an author who is ridiculing some idiot, I myself am rather amused. There may be some who will be turned off, and I will have lost them in those passages, but I suspect they'll be outnumbered by those who are amused." End quote. As I wrote my article, this is the only part of Dawkins' argument that rings false. No one reading The Greatest Show on Earth will come away thinking that Dawkins meant to be amusing in any conceivable manner. He's deadly serious, and he never backs off from his argument in any sense. He really believes, or at least he really claims, that those who disagree with him are insane, deluded, intellectually perverse, and unintelligent. Well, just remember all of this. He talks about evolution as the greatest show on earth. If you read the book, my guess is you're going to fail to see the grandeur that he sees in this. It's a very sterile worldview. I'm quite thankful it's not the only game in town. I'm quite positive it's not the greatest show on earth. And I'm also absolutely convinced that what he argues here is far beyond what he claims to be mandated by reason. I wrote another article I want to draw your attention to. You'll find it on my website at albertmuller.com. It has to do with another of the new atheists, in this case, Christopher Hitchens. Hitchens didn't write an article that's an atrocity. He wrote an article I think you'll find very interesting, and he published it in Vanity Fair. That is one of the periodicals of the celebrity interest amongst the cultural elite. It's not a place where you expect an article in the King James Bible. This year marks the quartcentenary, the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible. But Christopher Hitchens, who after all is one of the four horsemen of the so-called New Atheism, he writes with appreciation for the King James Version. He's provocative. He puts the history, the authorized version, that's what the British call the King James, in its context in the early years of the Stuart dynasty. He explains that the interest of King James I was to, quote, bind the majesty of the king to his devout people, end quote. And then he speaks with great appreciation for the language of the KJV text. He also states, when it comes to a lot of the modern translations, by the way, he compares the King James Version on 1 Corinthians 13:7, which says that love beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, and endureth all things. He compares that with the Good News Bible that translates it as love never gives up, and its faith, hope, and patience never fail. He says this, quote, "This doesn't read at all like the outcome of a struggle to discern the essential meaning of what is perhaps our most numinous word. It more resembles a smiley-faced Dale Carnegie reassurance. And as with everything else, it's designed to be instant, modern, and accessible. It goes out of date and out of time faster than Wisconsin cheddar," end quote. And as to do with gender-neutral translations, he says this, "To suggest that St. Paul, of all people, was gender-neutral is to rewrite history as well as to rinse out the prose," end quote. Well, I have to say, I'm largely sympathetic with Mr. Hitchens' aversion here to the worst of these modern translations. Now, as a Christian, I have to come back and say Luther was right that the Bible needs to be translated into the vernacular, the actual language of people, and we don't go around speaking like 16th century British citizens today. But at the same time, many of these modern translations are absolute atrocities that do indeed, and I love his phrase, rinse out the prose. But, you know, the reason I draw attention to this is not just because of some very, I think, pointed and, appreciative comments that Christopher Hitchens makes about the King James Version of the Bible, but to remind us that this leading figure in the New Atheism is himself struggling for his life in a fight against cancer. I think it says a great deal that two recent articles by Christopher Hitchens have had to do with the Bible. I think it tells us something that Christopher Hitchens is reading the Bible. I'm thankful that he's reading it. I'm thankful that he's concerned that we not rinse out the prose. I'm hoping that when Christopher Hitchens reads the Bible, he finds more than he might even be looking for. Finally, sometimes the news comes from an unexpected place. The local newspaper here in Louisville, the Louisville Courier-Journal, reported on two high school boys who have won a science fair contest with a project about the science fair. The hypothesis was the high school student fairs aren't really fair. Students often cut corners on research, and those with scientist parents do better. As Sarah Cunningham reports, that's what Manual High School juniors Michael Morin and Tyler Smith set out to determine through their science fair project. They discovered, by the way, that parental involvement and the number of students who break the rules, well, it's pervasive. So pervasive that their research has landed them a spot at the International Science Fair and has prompted changes at their own school, Manual High School here in Louisville, Kentucky. They concluded, quote, "We can say with 98% confidence that at least 60% of the Manual students who participate in the fair have committed acts of scientific misconduct. We also found that students who had lab access through a parent did significantly better in regional, state, and national competitions," end quote. A couple of insights from this. The first is that, of course, this kind of misconduct needs to be identified and dealt with for what it is. Scientific misconduct is far more pervasive than people would imagine, and it turns out that it starts fairly young, right in the science fair, and anyone who's been a parent knows exactly what this looks like. You know the temptation to help your child. You also know the competition for scholarships and all the rest that lead to the crucible of this kind of misconduct and parental involvement. But the second observation is this. If you look at the results, it's clear that parents who care and parents who are intellectually engaged have students who do better. Now, that's something that can't be leveled, whatever the rules might be. The world is an unfair place. The rules are there to make it as fair as possible. But even though this had nothing to do with the purpose for which this report was written in the local newspaper, the one thing that struck me that is missing from the analysis is you still can't take parents out of the equation. Parents need to follow the rules, but at the end of the day, it still matters that the student has parents who care and are involved. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. You'll find information about Southern Seminary by going to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. Next week, we'll be releasing A Thinking in Public with Kay Heimowitz. We're going to be talking about why boys aren't growing up to be men. You'll find that interesting. We'll have that up on Monday. And on Monday, I'll meet you again for The Briefing.